So as I was thinking, okay, how shall I proceed for these? We have 3 full days, and we had a bit last night, and then we have part of a day on Wednesday. It's an amount of time that I'm not used to, I'm not familiar with in terms of retreats. I usually do a week or more, or I do 2 days, a weekend, or one day. But this is kind of an in-between measure. And I like that idea. I'm very interested in how it will proceed, what will happen for people, what will happen for me, what will happen for the group. I know from experience that something will happen, and I trust entirely whatever it is. Something is already happening, and I trust that, whatever it is. But I don't know what it will be, and I don't know what it is. If I knew what it was, it wouldn't be what it is. It would be my idea of what it is. So I come to each moment beginning and letting go of that idea of my ideas of what that moment is. So I look at the tape recorder, and it's not a tape actually. I look at the recorder, and it's my idea of the recorder that I have. It's not the recorder just as the recorder. It's the recorder as it's being observed by me. Can I take the step back and there's the recorder? As soon as I call it recorder, it's already something else. It's already not just what it is. Of course, it's necessary to function in the world with those identifications. If we didn't, Nuno would not have brought the recorder, because he wouldn't have known what I was talking about. But we've agreed that there is a word, recorder, and it means this. And so he could say, oh, I have that. If we didn't have that agreement on that word, he wouldn't even have had this. This wouldn't even exist if we didn't have the word for it. But this practice is about experiencing this from the step back. And I don't remember if I said this to the group or if I said this to the people I was introducing meditation to last night, this notion of stepping back. So we have in the Zen tradition and in the greater Buddhist tradition, I hesitate to even identify Zen as Buddhist, although it is recognized as being part of the Buddhist tradition. For me, it's not. And it's not even Zen. Again, as soon as I call it something, then it's limited and it has a fixed identity. Everything is Zen. Like I said yesterday, it's not practice here and everyday life here. It's all one. But within this category of Buddhism and within this subcategory of Zen, we have 3 basic guidelines or basic principles of how we experience the world, how we identify the reality around us. One being unity or oneness, the unity of all things. The other being diversity, the differences of all things. And the third being harmony, the functioning of the two together, the unity and the diversity functioning together. We have other words for these three things. Sometimes we say Buddha for the first one, unity. Buddha being oneness, no separation, no categories, no colors, no light, dark, no man, woman, no... How far did you get? Dark, okay. No man, woman, no young, old, no fast, slow, no here, there, high, low. That's what we would call the Buddha aspect of reality. The second one, although it doesn't follow in order, is the Dharma, what we call the Dharma aspect, which is diversity, differences. And then everything that I said there was not in the Buddha aspect defines the Dharma aspect. That's the ceiling, that's the floor. That's a man, this is a woman. That's outside, this is inside. All of these differences. It's midday, it's not morning. Usually we limit ourselves to this aspect of reality. We experience the world most of the time from this aspect, because that's what's visible to us. And that is how we have grown and developed so that we can function in this world. And the other aspect, we have lost awareness of it. I cannot say we lost sight of it because we can't see it. This is the aspect of the world we can't see. This is the dark side of the moon. The very nature of that dark side of the moon is it's dark. If we could see it, it would be the light side. So this aspect we just are not aware of. It's not that we can't see it, we never will see it. And the third aspect is the harmony of the two, these two aspects together. In fact, they are not two. They're one. They function perfectly together. Both are present at every moment. Sometimes we refer to these as form and formlessness, or form and emptiness. When we say emptiness, it doesn't mean nothing. It refers to this unity Buddha aspect in which there are no definitions. Nothing is limited by a definition. It's not fixed. The forms as well are not fixed, but that's their emptiness aspect. That's the emptiness expresses in forms by the fact that they aren't solid, they don't last. Our emptiness or impermanent aspect is that we change all the time. We grow older. We lose hair. The cells in our body are constantly being born and dying. However, these two aspects work perfectly together, and that's the harmony aspect of our existence, of life. So to experience this, we've developed this practice. As I said yesterday, I guess to the group I was teaching meditation to, this exists beyond all traditions, beyond all churches, synagogues, practices. The practices, the churches, the doctrines have been developed in order to experience this. In my tradition, we use something that is called koans, which are stories, phrases, dialogues that have been handed down from generation to generation, most of them from ancient China in the 9th century, more or less. But they were incidents that really happened, or a phrase that someone really said that introduced someone to this awareness of the totality of reality. And because that happened, someone remembered it and said, oh, I can use this too. I can use this as an example and someone can learn from it. Someone else may have an opening from that story. One of the most famous ones is, what is your original face before your parents were born? Or what is the sound of one hand clapping? One hand clapping. And there are hundreds and hundreds of these that have been recorded. In fact, there are many more. Every moment is a koan. Koan is a Japanese word from the Chinese that just means a public case, a case that is an example that has been recorded and is used as an example. But every moment is also an example. Every moment is as uncomprehensible as these questions, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Everything is as unknown to us. But we have a lot of ideas about these things. We have a lot of, about the rest of things, we have a lot of ideas. And we think we know it. I came here with my ideas about what the weather would be like. Portugal, summer, hot. But that's not true, is it? It's not hot.
No.
And so I came with clothing that is not appropriate. I have one jacket. I have no sweaters. It's okay. It's not cold either, but it's not the heat I was expecting. I had a fixed idea. We have those fixed ideas about every moment, about everything. And when I say I arrive here and it's the beginning and I'm trying to figure it out, it's because I have ideas about how it should be, how I want it to be. And so I'm trying to understand what it is, because it doesn't correspond to my ideas. If I had no ideas, I would not be trying to figure anything out. I would just be present with what is. So in this practice, when we sit down on the cushion, we are training ourselves in this just being with what is. We don't know what will happen when we sit down. We have some ideas about what it will be, but we don't know. When we arrive at lunchtime, we don't know what will be served. Even Tiago, who's cooking, doesn't really know. He knows he was involved in the preparing of it, but he doesn't really know what it will be and how it will be received. He has some ideas and he has some hopes that it will be well received, but he doesn't really know. And we have hopes that it will be very good and that he has done a wonderful job cooking and that there will be a lot of it. Or maybe not, I don't know. But in fact, it won't be any of that. It won't correspond to our ideas, no matter what it is. Another one of these famous stories is about one of the key ancestors. I said yesterday that from the original person who began these teachings for us, he wasn't the first person in the universe from beginningless time to have experienced this reality as it is. He was the first one to develop the way that we express it, that I express it today. Was whom we call the Buddha, but he was just an ordinary man like the rest of us. I'm not an ordinary man, but he was an ordinary person like the rest of us. And that was 2,500 years ago. Since that time, he transmitted this teaching to one of his students, and then that student transmitted it to one of his students, and this went on and on and on for 2,500 years, 83 generations to me. I am the 83rd generation from that. That's what this line from me to the statue there is representing, symbolizes that. Now, one of these people, the sixth generation, although it wasn't really the sixth generation, it was the sixth generation after the teachings came to China. So for many, many generations, they were in India, and then someone brought them to China, and after it had been transmitted six times, there is this person who we think of as one of the key people, because his story was very particular, and also because he was the first one to then transmit it to several people. Instead of just being one person who received it, he transmitted it to several people, who then transmitted it to several people, who then transmitted it, and it became larger. So he's considered a key point. And one of the stories involving him is he, after he had been recognized by his teacher and been given the symbols of the transmission from teacher to student, he went off and disappeared for 10, 15 years. No one is sure exactly how long, but it was quite some time. And he lived in the countryside, he lived among ordinary people, he didn't identify himself as anything special, and lived a very ordinary life. One day he arrived at a monastery, probably to get food. It's not really clear why he came there. And in front of the monastery, there were two monks having a discussion. And they were looking at the flags. There were flags like out here, there are these Tibetan flags. There were flags outside the monastery and they were looking at it. And one of the monks had a position that it was the flag that was moving. And the other monk had the position that it was the wind that was moving. And they were very firm, each of them, in their positions, and arguing back and forth, becoming very, almost violent with one another. And he walked up and he heard them. And here he was, this probably what we would call a homeless person today, and probably had a long beard and not very nice clothing and probably didn't smell very good and maybe very thin because he didn't eat much. And he heard the discussion and he said to them, "It's not the flag that's moving. It's not the wind that's moving. It's your mind that's moving." Probably there was a reaction like this. What? What just happened there? Something happened. It was so quick, however, and so unknown that none of us really know what it was. And it doesn't matter if you knew what it was. Something happened there. That's why this story has been kept and told again and again and again and again. Now, in this practice, we would sit with that. We would think, it's not the wind that's moving, it's not the flag that's moving, it's my mind that's moving. What does that mean? Not in my head. You can't figure it out with your head. And part of what happens in that moment is our head has, like, when we have too many things going, too many electric things happening, we call that the circuit is blown. That's what happens in our head at that moment. Something similar to that. But immediately, it happens, and we don't know. And we quickly go fix the fuse. I don't know how you say that in Portuguese, where you flip the switch back or you replace whatever has blown out, and everything is back to normal. All of the appliances are back on, the dishwasher is going, the lights are on, the television, the computer, the hair dryer, it's all back on and functioning fine. What's very interesting is what happened in that moment. What is that moment? That moment is when we experience things just as they are. Without an idea, without a notion of, oh yes, I understand, or a desperation, I don't understand, that's stupid, or frustration, or falling asleep. Just that timeless instant of, I don't know. So that's an example of, we use koans for this. They are tools. There are many other tools. And most meditation practices that we receive from teachers are pointing towards that same moment. They have different ways of getting there, but they're all pointing to that moment. This whole retreat is one of those techniques. And then within the retreat, all of the different forms and structures and activities, the way of eating, the way of sitting, the rituals, the way of walking, all of that, the silence, they are all techniques as well to bring us to that moment. Two weeks ago, as I said, I was in France at a retreat. Claudia was there as well. There were more than 100 people. It was in a different place. The weather was different. The languages were different. The people were different. But it was the same. The same techniques. The same desire. The same intention. That's the oneness aspect. It's the same. The diversity aspect, of course, is there's a difference between 22 people and 100 people. And there's a difference between Portugal and France. And there's a difference between one teacher, me, sitting here, and there we were, I don't know, how many teachers were it? Four, five, maybe. There's a difference between let's see here, there's Portuguese, American, and Belgian, right? Those are the nationalities represented here. There were many more. There were Belgian, French, English, American, German, Dutch, Polish, Portuguese, many different nationalities. But we are all one. We are all in this together, he said. And to say that is not to deny the differences. And to see the differences is not to deny the oneness. And in the story of the flag and the wind, if we say it's your mind that's moving, because my mind is moving, I am making a distinction between wind and flag and not seeing the two functioning as one. And I'm making a distinction between me and flag and wind. If my mind is not moving, again, there's that moment. Now, very quickly, we try to hold that moment, keep it. We like it. There's a Zen story that says, trying to find the terms that would work. There's a mountain that is called no one, let's say. No one. And on this mountain, there is a tree that is called often we say enlightenment or awakening or maybe we could say being here now, something like that, seeing things as they are. And the story is that if you eat that fruit from that tree, you will have great awakening. You will just be here now. You will see things as they are. And so people have heard about this tree, and they go about eating fruit everywhere, trying to have that. And the fruit sometimes is very good, and then so they keep eating it. It's very sweet. And then they eat too much of it, or they go to another tree and it's not very sweet, or some of the fruit makes them fall asleep, some of the fruit drugs them. But none of it is what all these different trees they're trying does not have that fruit that brings them great awakening, brings them to just being here now. Because the problem is that they didn't hear the part about the tree being on this mountain that is called no one. The only place where that tree can be found with that fruit is on this mountain that is called no one. Meaning, as long as I am still someone, as long as I am identified with myself, I can never find that tree with that fruit. As long as I have these ideas about me and you, as long as I am coming to this moment with all of my positions, my points of reference, my identities, I can't find that tree with that fruit on it. And as soon as I do, every tree has that fruit. Because I am that mountain, and I am that tree, and I am that fruit. So, as I was saying that, I thought of something else, and I can't remember now what it was, but... one way possibly of thinking of it, when we're sitting and we just allow things to come up, very quickly we, maybe even from the very beginning, we already are caught in something that we're thinking about. We're tired, or we're anticipating, oh no, 40 minutes, or we're uncomfortable, or we're very happy, we want it to stay just like this. When we are involved in those kinds of things, we are focusing on the content of our thoughts or our emotions. We become fixed on what is in them. What do they contain? Happiness, sadness, fear, anger, discomfort, pleasure, joy. I can't either. There's so many that it's just innumerable. But actually what we're not, in this practice, we're not concerned with what the thoughts contain. There are other places to deal with that. In the workplace, in the universities, in psychotherapy, in other fields we deal with the content of the thought. Here we are dealing with the nature of the thought. What is the nature of the thought? Not its content, but what is its nature? The same thing I can say about myself, because immediately when I have a thought, I identify with that thought. I am having the thought. I am the creator of that thought. And so, if I like that thought, I like myself. Ah, that's a wonderful thought. That's beautiful. I like that. I'm good. Or if I don't like it, oh, I don't like that thought. That's bad. That's ugly. I shouldn't have that thought. Then I don't like this person. Oh, I'm terrible. I shouldn't think those things. I'm bad. Or I'm not smart. That's a stupid thought. Or I'm very smart. That's a very intelligent thought. So it goes together. So if instead of looking at the content of the thought and the content of this, what is the nature of this? What is the nature of the thought? And what is the nature of the thinker? Again, we have that moment. Because suddenly, the thought and the thinker, we've taken a tiny step back. Okay, well, I don't know. Well, who doesn't know? And who is trying to think, what is the nature of the thinker? And who is trying to think, what is the nature of the thought? And we take the step back again. This is the equivalent of, it's not the flag that's moving, it's not the wind that's moving, it's your mind that's moving. What is mind? What is moving? Whose mind? Who is moving? All of these questions. Instead of being occupied with what is this thought? What is the content of this? I shouldn't have this thought. I like that thought. If I think this, then that. And then I start planning, organizing. As I said yesterday when I was introducing the breathing, the very basic technique, which is the same thing as what I'm talking about. It's just a different version of it, but it's not so important to be able to count the breath. That's not what's important. The important thing is that moment when we come back, when we have realized we're not counting it anymore, we're thinking about breakfast, or thinking about the chickens, or the dogs barking, or what this building was before they made it, or the kind of plant in the corner, or whatever we're thinking about. Maybe we don't even know what we're thinking about. We're off somewhere and we're completely lost. The important moment is when we become aware. Ah, yes. I was thinking about something else when I wanted to be counting my breath. It's not analyzing how I'm breathing. It's not accomplishing, arriving at counting my breath. And that's not what the practice is about. So we can look at the retreat itself and then the practice that we do here as being a a technique, a structure to help us plunge into the moment. Plunging into the moment means it's like when you plunge into the water in a swimming pool or the ocean or lake, even the shower maybe. There is a moment when you don't know. You can be you maybe the water is cold and you're hesitating and you have ideas about what it will be and not wanting to go and wanting to go but not wanting to go, and then at some moment you just plunge. That's what this is. That's what the retreat is. You've done all the arranging, you got here, many difficult ways or not difficult arrangements. You left your homes and you came here, plunged in. And the first day is really that. Just plunge in. This is the Buddha aspect. The Buddha aspect is a plunge. We're not worried about the differences and the colors and the morning, night, what things mean. If we've been here before or not. What we will do, what it will be like tomorrow. No, we're just... just plunge in. It would be the equivalent of just walking outside and there's the flags. We're just there. We haven't thought yet. The flag is red. The flag is moving. No, it's not the flag. It's the wind. What is that flag? It's a Tibetan flag. What does that mean? Why do the Tibetans have it? How did it get here? Why do these people have it? None of that. It's just the initial plunge. Very quickly, the next aspect will come and just that quickly. And we will start seeing the differences and making categories and separating. So in that second, when that second aspect is there, we take a step back and we practice what we call not knowing. I don't know. That's what I said about the recorder. I look at it. I have a lot of ideas about it. I try to figure out what the numbers mean. I think, is the microphone getting it? What will happen after? It's a Marcus Phillips, there's a red light, all of this stuff. But if I take a step back and I don't know what that is. I don't know what will become of it. If with a person, I say I'm walking down the street, I bump into someone. Initially, I just have contact with the person. But then I might think, oh, that person is very rude, not polite. That person is not paying attention. That person is aggressive. I don't like that person. I do like that person. Oh, he has nice eyes. Or, oh, he's not nice, or whatever. Can I take a step back and, I don't know. Something happened. I met this person. But I don't know. Can I open to whatever it is, to whatever that person is, whatever the incident is, without my ideas about it already? Without thinking, oh, he's stupid and he's hurt me and I'm going to be late. I could have fallen in the street, whatever. So what I'm saying is, we have to acknowledge the diversity aspect, the differences, but can we acknowledge those differences without judging them? Can we say there is a man and there is a woman without saying the man is better than the woman is better than the man? Can we say it's afternoon without thinking afternoon is better than morning, or, oh, it's not a nice afternoon, it should be hotter, it's too much sun, whatever. Can we just notice the difference without judging it? If we can, our experience of the world is transformed. We experience things just as they are. And when I told this about the thoughts and looking not at the content but at the nature, if we can become less identified with the content of the thoughts, then, when I say less identified, not judging them, not putting them in categories, not holding or rejecting them, then we just experience the thought as it is. It arises and it falls away. Another thought arises and falls away, as with everything. And then we just experience things as they are and we're free. That's what this practice is about, nothing else. It's not about being somewhere else. It's not about arriving in paradise. It's not about being a wonderful person. It's not about becoming the Dalai Lama. It's not about becoming forever young, beautiful, having everything we want, being fully satisfied. It's not at all. It's just very simply about being here now with what is. So sometimes when people ask me, what did you get from this practice? Or what will this practice bring me? I have to tell them the truth, which is nothing. And again, as with so many of these things that I say, that's the good news and the bad news. The bad news is that if you're expecting something, you won't get it. Although that's also the good news. Because there's nothing to get. You have it all already. There's no one to become because you already are it. There's nowhere to go because you're already here. That's the good news and the bad news, as I say. The bad news, from the perspective of, I would like to be somewhere else, I would like to be someone else, and I would like to have something. But there's nothing to have, there's nowhere to go, and there's no one to be. And in that moment when it's not the wind moving, it's not the flag moving, it's your mind moving. That's what we experience. Everything is in its place. And that's why it feels, it's hard to even say it feels good, it feels right. Everything is in its place. And where is that place? From the Buddha aspect, the unity aspect, we would say, no place. From the diversity, Dharma aspect, we would say, every place. Everywhere. But everywhere, where do you situate everywhere? It's always here. So, what is the time?
1 o'clock.
Okay. Does anyone have questions or comments? Anything you'd like to say? Does it bring anything up for you? Confusion or question?
Because sometimes I find myself counting and
The mind is very clever, very strong. It quickly discovers that that's possible. And sometimes even has many different layers going on of counting, thinking about this, and then thinking about that, and thinking about that all at once. Yes, there are other techniques, hundreds, many, many, many techniques. However, what happens is, if we jump from technique to technique, it's the equivalent of the mind having all of these things going on. It's easier, in fact, although it maybe doesn't seem like it at the beginning, it's easier to stick with one thing and discover all of the difficulties and tricks and pains or joys involved in it. And it's more powerful as well, instead of doing different techniques. In some traditions, the certain Tibetan practices, the teacher will give a technique, and the practitioner has to do it, you know, 300,000 times or something. Just unbelievable dedication to that practice. But there's something very powerful in that. And my experience with the breath, the counting the breath, when I first started doing it, was that the first time someone showed me, it was the first time anyone showed me how to sit, and we sat face to face, and she told me the practice, and we did it for maybe 5 minutes, I don't know, 10 maybe. And then she said, "So what happened?" And I said, "Oh, I found myself at 120. So instead of stopping at 10, I was so determined to do it that I just kept counting. And then I realized, oh no, that's not good, and all of that stuff. Well, I kept doing it, and after a few months, I didn't really like it, in fact, the practice. And I went on my first retreat, which was, actually I think it was probably 3 days, maybe like this. But it was even more, it seemed even more tight and more strict. And the sitting periods were all 40 minutes. There was none of this 40, 30, 30, it was 40 minutes. And there were no interviews with the teacher. It was a Japanese teacher and he hardly spoke English or French. And there were no, he would give a talk like this sometimes, but I couldn't really understand what he was saying. He was speaking English, but I didn't know what he was talking about. And it was silent, and I didn't know anyone, and it was just terrible. I just hated it. On one hand, I hated it, but on the other hand, I really liked it. And I was doing this, I was supposed to be doing counting my breath, but I wasn't. And I was getting really bored, sitting on these uncomfortable cushions. My knees were hurting, and it was cold. It was October, and I was just fed up. And I think this was probably the end of the first day, afternoon of the first day. And so I said, okay, well, and I was sitting in front of a window like this, big, and there was you could see far, and there were hills and things. And I said, okay, well, I have a choice. I can sit here and be bored and uncomfortable and struggle and fight and hate it. But I don't really want to do that. I want something else. And the only thing I could think of doing was counting my breath, because that was the only technique anyone had ever given me. So, and I couldn't ask this teacher. I didn't really know him. And he didn't talk to people anyway, and he didn't speak English or French really well anyway, so the only option was to use the technique I'd been given. So I did. I sat there and I did it. Well, something did happen. Probably, the next day, at the end in the afternoon, at some point in the next day. Suddenly, I was no longer bored. And it was as if the hills were breathing or something. Everything was alive. The hills, I don't know. I didn't understand. I didn't know what had happened, but I was no longer bored and everything was alive. And at the end of the rest of the time was, I just did it. I just kept doing it and had no problem doing it. And at the end of the third day, the teacher asked us all to go around and say something. And people said things, whatever was happening for them. I don't know. I don't even remember, really. And then it came to me, and I didn't know what to say. I really didn't know what to say. And so I said, the only thing I can say is, I'm just breathing. And the teacher looked at me and he said, is it you who's breathing or the universe? It was one of those moments of, is the flag moving or the wind moving? And I said, it's the same thing. I didn't know that. I didn't know that I would say that. I hadn't been thinking, I and the universe are one breathing. I didn't know that. But when he asked me, that's what the response was, because that's what it was. Now, I can't say that this is always my experience. And I can't say that I always, when I go to that breathing technique, that's what happens. No. But it's an example of the possibility of what can happen. And anyone who really does a technique will tell you a similar story. But you have to stay with it. And even when you don't stay with it, then just come back, and that's okay. You're still staying with it by coming back to it. It's not about succeeding in doing it. It's staying with it. So whatever you do with it, as long as you're coming back to it and straying from it, you're still with it. That was a long answer. Wasn't my intention. Another teacher in my lineage says that when someone asked him, how can I know if this practice is right for me? Meaning not necessarily the breathing practice, but the whole Zen trip. And he said, it's not difficult. If you really do this practice, it's like I'm saying, if you really do the breathing, one of two things will happen. One, you will discover that this is your practice, this is for you, and you will keep doing it. Or you will discover that this is not your practice and you will not keep doing it. And you will do something else and you will go find what is your practice. But in either case, you have to really do it to find out. You can't sort of try it out and think, oh, no, I don't really like this. That may be what comes up for you if you really do it. It will become clear. Because, as I was saying to the people last night when I was introducing it, it's like a jar of muddy water, this practice. If you put it down, as we're doing, we're putting down this jar of muddy water, things will settle and the water will be clear. So what you need to do will become clear. It maybe won't look like what you think you need to do, but it will become clear. And therefore, no, this is not for me. Or yes, this absolutely is for me. You don't know what that means, this is for me. Or you don't know what that means, this is not for me. But there will be something that is clarified. So.
You propose that we apply some technique from yesterday. I'm just sitting and noticing, not focus on reading or counting or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You are proposing that for us to apply some technique that we know, or counting or focusing on breath or whatever.
Yeah. Yesterday there were some people who were had never had any experience with sitting before. And so I introduced them to the posture and gave them a basic technique because they have never done this before. In your case, where you have plenty of experience with sitting, if you feel the need for a technique, I think you probably would know when to apply it. If you don't, then that maybe is a technique too, just of letting things be, of observing and noticing things. So, no, I'm not recommending, because she had never had any experience and I gave her that technique, I advised it. Because we do need to cultivate some basic stability physically and in our mind. And we have to have some basic concentration in order to then allow things just to be. It's the equivalent of putting down that jar of water. But once your mind has become stable, more or less, then whatever comes up, comes up. Now, if people are people with whom I work with directly and who have chosen to practice this Zen path as I manifest it and as I transmit it, then I might suggest other things. I might, if I know that person and their practice and where they are and what their obstacles are at that moment, I might suggest something else. But that would be more on an individual basis. That's okay. Because the point is not the techniques, actually, as we always say. And the famous Zen image of, we use the finger to point at the moon, and often what happens is we confuse and we pay attention to the finger rather than to the moon. And the finger is just pointing at it. And that's what the techniques are doing as well. Okay, well, if there are no other questions, that's probably enough of me talking. Okay.